The Monocle Arts Review was first broadcast on the 19th of March 2015 on Monocle 24.
Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Robert Bound. This is your daily appointment with our international critics and cultural experts about the shows to see, the books to read and the records to stick on repeat each week. Cathy Rensenbrick is Associate Editor at The Bookseller and Director of Quick Reads, and she joins me today to review John Ronson's latest adventure in his new release, So You've Been Publicly Shamed, Matt Haig's personal battle with the stigmas of depression in Reasons to Stay Alive, and the latest novel from Patrick Gale entitled A Place Called Winter. That is all coming up right here on the Monocle Arts Review on Monocle 24. Cathy, welcome to the programme. It's
Hi.
Our first time on here together.
Let's
pray that it all goes wonderfully well. We're going to kick off with John Ronson's book, which I loved. I finished reading it last week. And I think it's his best book. Talk us through the territory in which he's delving into this time around.
Yes, it's exhilarating, isn't it? I think it's an intellectual shot in the arm.
Yeah.
He's looking at shame, and he's looking at shame both as it operates historically, but more relevantly as it operates right now, and how things like social media has given us the ability to attempt to publicly shame people. So he takes us through some well-known case studies and also examines what it is about us collectively, how group madness takes over, and then we long to sort of hound someone to their social death.
And he comes up with, he kind of goes to Boston, doesn't he? And he looks at kind of public records from the sort of early 18th century in terms of people being put in the stocks and these kind of weird kind of quasi-medieval ways of shaming people publicly. Town square kind of, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Rotten Tomatoes kind of thing.
Of course, we're all familiar with that, and the concept of, you know, the A for adultery that used to be branded on adulterous women.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of mechanisms of public shame that have happened over the centuries. And then, of course, the new way it can be done is publicly on social media.
And he's got some really great, he's got some great examples. Justine Sacco, who works as a PR director in New York and sent a tweet, something along the lines of, I'm going to Africa for work. I hope I don't get AIDS. It's okay. I'm white.
Mm-hmm.
And was then, by the time she took off from New York and landed in Cape Town or Joburg, she kind of practically lost her job and had been sort of massively hated by hundreds of thousands of people all over the world.
A worldwide trending topic, had become this negative celebrity for what she felt was an ironic comment,
a take on her privileged status.
Yeah.
And as we said, John Ronson on fine form with this. One of the things he's so fearless in, and presumably dogged in, trying to track down and keeping on trying to track down the people that have kind of lit up this rather sad world of public shaming on Twitter and the like. It's I guess one of the strengths of the book is his determination to always go to the source of all these things.
Yes, he does. And I think part of the power of the book is he will interview the person that's been shamed, and he will try to find the shamers and then to work out how they're both doing. I just found it completely fascinating. It tells you so much about how we behave. I definitely felt it was quite a good guidebook on how to be a moral person in the modern world. I hope I wasn't about to start shaming people, but if I was, I would have stepped back.
Yes,
there's a bit of a
sort of like 11th commandment sort of aspect to it.
Think before you shame.
Yeah, exactly. Well, look, we're going to have a clip actually, and we're going to have a brief excerpt of So You've Been Publicly Shamed. Here, John Ronson is describing a conversation with his editor after undergoing a prosthetic makeover to turn him into a woman for a story.
A week had passed and our relationship remained frosty. She felt I'd prevaricated unprofessionally and was acting too sensitive. Don't overthink it, John, she'd emailed me. It's just a fun feature. Shouldn't be the cause of some sort of midlife crisis. I felt that the story's original premise had fallen to pieces, and the reason why they were happy to send me out into the world looking nothing like a woman was because in our line of work, the more humiliated a person is, the more viral the story tends to go. Shame can factor large in the life of a journalist, the personal avoidance of it and the professional bestowing of it onto others. Nobody must ever see those test pictures, I'd been thinking all week. Never.
That was quite a nicely read little excerpt from John Ronson's new book, which is called So You've Been Publicly Shamed. There he was kind of, presumably, he was kind of looking at his own sort of I suppose, parameters of shame, what he will do and won't do as a journalist. And in the book, as you will know, Kathy, and we can share with our readers a fetching portrait of him. I mean, it's in black and white, and
yeah,
certainly in the
fairly
version
convincing
I had.
After
but
all that.
Yeah, you know, that was all right. I don't know quite, I can't quite recognise the newspaper that was going to be from the offices, but I think I can take a guess, as his usual. Usually writing for The Guardian here in the UK. Yeah, it's a fascinating, as you said, it's a sort of fascinating idea. And he talks a little bit about his own sense of shame and how he was sort of bullied when he was a kid and how he was fat when he was a kid and then he was bullied when he was a kid. It doesn't get, he's not pruriently interested in his own shame, simply in order to perhaps dot I's and cross T's of other shamers and shamies between the covers of his new
book.
Yeah,
I think he's looking for what's the motivation that lies beneath all of this. There's quite an interesting bit about the 19th century French doctor who had views on public madness and how, you know, how that sort of groups can come together and behave very badly. So, but that, I mean, the whole thing, I think it's wonderful. And it's such a good read.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing. Interestingly as well, I mean, actually, I think all our listeners all over the world will be fairly familiar with Max Mosley's public shaming. He was the boss of the FIA, the Formula One racing body or the motorsport body. And then he appeared on the front page of the News of the World here in the UK in what was called a sick Nazi orgy. It was proved not to be in the High Court or the Supreme Court. But Max Mosley, quite an interesting read to read about him, because he seemed to be impervious to shame. He was just like, well, that's happened.
He just told the truth about what happened.
Yeah.
And was sort of bullish about it. Because that is a fascinating thing about the modern world, isn't it? If you do like doing peculiar things, does that mean that everyone has the right to, you know, to what people do feel they have the right to kind of judge? And of course, in that case, the newspaper described it as Nazi, which it wasn't, and that was proved. But presumably, in most cases, those of us that would be less impervious, which I think would be almost anyone, would be so sufficiently embarrassed by the situation that you'd probably just run away.
Yeah.
But he sort of stood up and fought. Again, that was a slightly unexpected side effect for me of reading the book. I came out of it thinking, Max Mosley, nice guy.
Yeah, exactly. You know where to find him. We were talking there about John Ronson's new book, which is called So You've Been Publicly Shamed. And it's quite a brilliant read. And we're going to move on now to another non-fiction release, this time by Matt Haig. It's called Reasons to Stay Alive, and it's about the stigma that surrounds depression and draws on his own experiences with the disease. And he contemplated throwing himself off a cliff when he was 24. Matt Haig, a name with which I'm familiar, but fill us out on this one. Is this in unusual territory for him? I mean, we're talking about a non-fiction title. I mean, this seems quite bare bones.
He's written lots of novels, and he becomes increasingly successful, I think. His last novel, The Humans, was wonderful and has done very well. And he says that he has always wanted to really write about mental health. Usually he's doing it in a novel through some kind of metaphor that might not particularly be obvious. If you read The Humans with a view to thinking about depression, then you can completely see that a lot of it is a metaphor. But he decided to do it head on.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting thing knowing an author's back catalogue and then when they do a non-fiction work, kind of going, oh, that's what they were all about.
Yeah.
Does it feel like that? Can you kind of lay the tracing paper of one over the other and see where those things meet up? Or is that a bit of a facile way of
looking at
them?
You can. I do think actually I think in general authors tend to have a limited amount of preoccupations, as we do as people. We tend to be...
Speak for yourself, Kathy. Yeah, exactly.
We tend to return to our own particular preoccupations about things. And I think writers usually tend to be exploring their own preoccupations. It might not be particularly obvious. So the plot might not obviously seem to be about what it's about. And then when you look at it and you think, oh, it's all about his dead father again.
Right, yeah.
But it's actually about, I don't know, dogs or croquet or something.
Now, that is a well-disguised allegory.
Very well-disguised.
And what is Matt Haig's style? Is this lyrical or is it quite kind of bare-bones stuff?
It's bare-bones. Yeah. It's very well-written. It's very funny, actually. And it sounds a bit peculiar to say. It's sort of a laugh-out-loud, riotous read when it is all... He doesn't shirk away from confronting the terror, really, of depression and the fact that it can be life-threatening. He talks a bit about... you know, he tries to do some research. He finds out things himself that he didn't realise. So, for example, he thought that kind of people did understand brain chemistry. And as he tries to research it so he can write about it, he realises that actually nobody does. All sorts of issues like whether or not to try to medicate for depression, which is another whole big area. But it's also a very hopeful book. He is now in a very hopeful place. He's married to the woman who kind of held his hand through the depression all those years. They have beautiful children. He has a beautiful career. And he largely manages his state of mind, and quite a lot of good practical advice about that.
That's an interesting thing, talking about the practical advice as well, because I guess maybe, well, you can tell us whether you feel that there was the temptation within those quite handsome hardcovers to slightly fictionalise, to push the boundaries, to rather than editorialise, to fictionalise depression. Do you get that sense, or do you think he's really walked away from his fictional personas?
Yeah, I think he's just telling it as it is. I think his aim is to kind of make sense of his own experience and do so in a way that can be helpful to other people. One of the things he says is that it was really with the humans that he kind of came out as being a depressive. And he says that is how it feels. It feels like coming out.
Yeah.
But he says one of the things that actually he finds comforting himself is that when it turns out to have been of use to other people, that he will share his experiences. So he decided to do it in a book. I think it'd also be a very useful book for anybody struggling, not just for somebody who maybe is getting depression for the first time, doesn't understand it, but for anybody trying to live with somebody with depression, which I think that's always a difficult situation to be in. Because obviously one of the things about depression is you can't really explain it when you're in it because everything's just pointless. You can't even be bothered to try to explain
it. Presumably that's part and parcel of it. You can't pass on any of your learning about it because you don't have the motivation to do so.
And I think this is such an interesting book because he does look back at his breakdown and try to describe it. I don't think there's very much good writing about depression at all. And I think it's exactly because of that reason.
Fiction and non.
Yeah. When depressed, it feels completely pointless to try and make a record of it. When not depressed, it's kind of slightly difficult to remember what it was like. So I think he's put it on the page very well.
Just lastly on this this memoir, I suppose we can call it, by Matt Haig, as someone that works for the bookseller, how do you describe that? Where does it sit on bookshelves? How does that get marketed?
Good question, actually. It's tricky because it's not really memoir, it's not really self-help, it's somewhere in the middle. We do like, in the book industry, we really dislike books that break the rules until one breaks the rules very well, and then we like it a lot.
Okay.
So I think this is firmly in that category. It's speeding up the bestseller list.
It's pecking out its own pigeonhole.
That's exactly it. It will find its own little space in windows and on shop tables.
Okay, well, that was Reasons to Stay Alive, which is new from Matt Haig. That's published by Canongate. Lastly, we're going to go to Patrick Gale's new novel, and this is called A Place Called Winter. Are we in familiar Patrick Gale here? He cranks them out, doesn't he, Patrick Gale?
Well, I mean, he's written a few very good novels. I think it's unfamiliar in that I don't think he usually looks at historical. This is inspired by a situation in his own family, his great-grandfather, apparently. This is loosely based on his great-grandfather's story. I think it's new territory for him. And also, part of it is set in Canada. So it's a great, wide-ranging, but still in lots of ways a very intimate tale. I really enjoyed it.
What is Patrick Gale's style? I mean, as you say, he's gone historical with this. Is he trying to write the great almost Canadian novel here? But does he feel like he's got the facilities of a modern novelist or a contemporary novelist, and he's sort of backdating them with this? How would you describe his style to our listeners?
Well, I think he just writes very good books that it tends to be about the people motivations. And again, despite the fact that this is set in the past and in Canada, it's similar territory to his other books. He's just interested in people and why they work and how they work. He is a gay person and a gay writer, so often his novels will have gay characters and deal with gay issues. And in this case, the story is that Harry Kane, who's a married man in kind of turn of the century London, has an illicit affair with a man, writes him some unwise love letters, and then when somebody else finds them, Harry is blackmailed. And the deal is that if he doesn't want his family to be exposed to shame, that he will emigrate to Canada and never see them again. And this apparently did happen to Patrick Gale's great-grandfather.
Wow. So we have an element of shame. We at our denouement.
That's a shame, yes.
We've got a bit of a coda going on, shameful coda. And not wanting to ask the same question again, but that's an interesting thing. When a writer is a gay man or a gay woman, how does that work in terms of marketing it? Do you have to, is that something you almost don't want to tell people? You just say, it's an amazing love story. Or do you feel that you've almost got a right to tell people, or you've got a duty to tell people that it might not be how they think of a love story? I'm always interested in terms of that thing, because when I review books for the magazine or we talk about things, you kind of it's necessary to mention it because it's, you know, maybe it's unusual or something. But it's,
I think it's an endlessly fascinating question. It's a whole big subject in itself because there's a whole thing about representation, isn't there? I always want to look at a book, or indeed actually a person, just as their person. And then there's the whole thing that if you are a white, straight male, you get to be the norm. And if you're anything other than that, you then somehow become representative of all people who are like you. So you never kind of want to get into that. Having said that, there will be people out there that really want to read a gay love story.
Yeah, so. But you do, it's one of those. I'm almost envisaging the Amazon page or something where it's sort of, it says, you might also like Alan Hollinghurst. And you're like, oh God, you know, spare me from this this two-dimensional.
It's, some bookshops have sort of sections in gay writing, black writing, and there's a continual debate about
whether that's useful or not.
Whether or not that's useful.
Okay, well, we were talking there about Patrick Gale's new novel. It's called A Place Called Winter. That sounds like fascinating stuff as well. Always, a bit of history repeating
itself. Really good. And also mental illness, how people looked at homosexuality around the turn of the century, how it was viewed, and it was viewed as a mental illness that could be cured.
And that is published by Tinder Press. Kathy, it's really nice talking to you, talking us through John Ronson's new book, Matt Haig's new book, and Patrick Gale's new book. Kathy Rensenbrick is Associate Editor at The Bookseller and Director of Quick Reads. Thank you very much for joining us. You've been tuned into the Monocle Arts Review with me, Robert Bound. Tomorrow, Steve Bloomfield will be joined by Little White Lies magazine's David Jenkins for our weekly film review. For the time being, thanks for tuning in.